You want me to tell you something about my background?
Well, I was going to say, let me introduce the tape so that we know who we are. My name is Ann Smith, and I'm a volunteer at the University of Florida Oral History Program. And today is October 23rd, 2008. I'm interviewing Aurelia Wallace, who has asked me to call her Chick, and we are in her home in Gainesville, Florida. And now, is that, do you have a middle name, or
yes,
give me your whole name?
My full name is Catherine Aurelia Dunstan Wallace.
Okay. And how do you spell Dunstan?
D-U-N-S-T-A-N, as in St. Dunstan, Archbishop of Canterbury.
All right.
And we've traced it back that far. But the interesting thing is that even though he was a man of the church, he was not celibate. And he has little Dunstan distributed all over England.
I see. All right. So that's your full name. Mm-hmm. And where were you born?
I was born in Madison, Wisconsin on August 1, 1925,
uh-huh.
where my father was a graduate assistant and my mother was a graduate student.
Oh.
In language. They both were linguists. And my mother had just come back from 4 years in France, living in France to further her French. She was from Boston and Lincoln, Nebraska. My father was from North Carolina. And they met when they both moved into the French house where you have to speak French all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And my mother said she never heard my father speak a word of English until after they were married. And she was astounded because he had a southern accent.
And you couldn't tell it in French.
I couldn't tell it in French.
I'll be darned. That's a wonderful story. That's a wonderful story.
So I was born there in the loved the snow, wouldn't sleep unless I was put out on the 20 degree below zero sleeping porch.
Is that right?
Yeah, now I can't stand cold weather.
I'll be darned.
So that's where I spent my first couple of years. I've never been back. I've been close. In fact, a week or so ago, we were within about 40 miles of there at a 99th Bomb Group reunion of Phil's Army people. And we didn't take time to go up there.
I
just barely remember it because we left there when I was 2 and a half.
That was my next question. Mm-hmm. So you were little.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's cold country. There's no question about that. So gives me.
So my father got an offer from Greensboro College in Greensboro, North Carolina, a small Methodist girls' school. The president had been a teacher of his when they were both at Duke.
Sure.
In the 20s, and he was offered the headship of the French, the language department.
I see.
And he said that he's the only person he knows that started at the top and went down ever since.
Oh, that's interesting.
Anyway, where I grew up was a medium, so 50,000 people in 1930. That was a fair-sized southern town.
And where now
this
are
we? This is Greensboro, North Carolina.
Greensboro, okay.
And
did you have sisters and brothers?
I had one sister, 4 years younger. She and I were totally, totally opposite. We were too far apart in age to be companionable and too far apart in personality to ever have any interest in each other.
Uh-huh.
So she left home as fast as she could, which was freshman in college, and never came back. She married an impecunious artist in New York, and they lived there a while. Then they moved to San Francisco where the Modern Art Center was.
Sure.
And she never came back to Greensboro. My folks went out to see her 2 or 3 times, and I went to see her frequently because I was traveling then giving lots of lectures.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And every time I'd go to San Francisco, I'd go out and see her. But it was like seeing a stranger, you know, just somebody.
Just never
I knew.
Were close.
We were never close.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she was the first person in this country to die of mad cow disease.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
When was that?
Oh, maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And she had picked it up in Paris when she went there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Probably in Normandy,
dear.
Because she was once whole summer on a farm in Normandy.
Uh-huh.
And that's where they thought she died.
Oh, how unfortunate.
So she died at 60 or something like
oh,
that.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
And no other siblings. And we lived out in the country, and I had no playmates at all except boys until I was about 10 years old.
That's not bad. You learned some different
games.
Well,
I learned how to run fast and hold on to my panties.
Oh, good idea. Good idea. That lesson could hold you in good stead all your life.
And Phil lived across the street in the summers with his grandmother. In the winter, he lived in town. But he and I went to elementary, junior high, senior high together. And yet we only had one date in all those years. We played together out in the country, but we were not... We didn't think we were in love or anything like
that. Sure, sure. And this was all in North Carolina.
All in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Yeah. Now, did your mother work during that time?
Part of the time she did.
Or I should say work outside the home.
She was a language teacher, too. And she, when the war came, or just before the war, she took over the position of the head of the department at Guilford College, a Quaker college in Greensboro, which is well known. And thoroughly enjoyed that. And she taught until after I was married, I guess. I got married as soon as I graduated from college, which was in 1945.
Now, she taught language, did you say?
She taught French and Spanish. And as a result of their being linguists, our home was filled all the time. I never remember a time when we didn't have somebody foreign living with us. From 1931, when we had two Chinese girls escaping the revolution in China.
Really?
And they were all funneled to us. We weren't Quakers, but they were funneled to us through the Quaker Foundation. And we had people from Poland, Germany, Russia, several people from Russia, several people from Poland, some from South America.
Well, how fascinating.
I didn't sleep in my own bedroom from the time I was 8 years old until long after I was married. In fact, one of the Polish guys, my mother had a habit of taking in waifs, and this was a Polish, perfectly lovely man, a sociologist, who just couldn't keep a job. His English wasn't all that good, and he didn't have good people skills. He just bounced from one two-year temporary thing to another. And when I got married, he moved into my bedroom upstairs, and he stayed 9 years. When they moved down here, 9 years later, he moved along with them.
Is that
so
right?
My mother got busy, and many contacts, found a perfectly lovely English girl and got them together, and they got married, and they moved down here, and they had two children named for my father and mother, Bob and Kay.
Isn't that something?
And the children are still here. One of them is married to an optometrist who has an office over in the First Publix store near there.
I'll be darned. Well, now, as a child with all of this international influence, how did you feel about that?
Well, some of the time I felt intruded upon, but they were always so interesting, and I learned so much. We had people who had been in concentration camps, who had run from Hitler, from Stalin.
Oh, I bet.
Just all kinds of unbelievable stories. An average child would never be exposed to anything like this.
No, that's right.
So I felt as though... I felt it even then that this was a great opportunity.
Did
because
you?
I knew I was going to be a writer, and I was just...
You knew that early on?
Yeah. Oh, when I was 6 years, 7 years old.
Isn't that something?
I had a poem published in the little school paper when I was 7 years old, something about a squirrel, squirrely, whirly, twirly.
You know, let me know when you want your blueberry juice or whatever you want.
Okay, anytime.
Well, I think that, you know, those kinds of experiences are just so enriching, and yet you're right. You know, you don't have your own bedroom, and
I slept in the kitchen sometimes on
the
cot because there were
people in the house.
One time we had 14 foreigners sleeping in our house. We had a 2-story house.
Wow!
But
what wonderful parents, you know.
They loved it. My mother said she gained so much from her 4 years in France that she could never repay that debt to Europe.
Yes. Yes.
And, of course, my father was very gregarious and a wonderful storyteller, and people would just hang on his every word. It was a great ego boost.
Well, sure. Well, sure.
And it was wonderful for us kids to hear all these things.
And to have that as a modeling behavior. Oh, I would think so. I think that's excellent. So you went to high school, still in Greensboro, and that's where you graduated?
Mm-hmm, that's where I graduated.
Okay.
At graduation, I won the Quill and Scroll International Writing Scholarship.
Yes.
And they were to be taken at places like City College of New York, New York University, the University of Washington in the West, San Francisco. I was within a half a year of being 16 when I graduated.
Really?
I couldn't imagine myself going to New York or San Francisco. I'd never been anywhere.
Everybody'd come to you.
Yeah. So I chose the closest one, which was the University of Georgia, and that changed my life forever. Because I met the man who was to be my husband, who was the first GI, the first service person to be on the GI Bill in 1943, I guess it was, when it passed.
Uh-huh.
So we went to Washington and we were celebrated all over the place.
Celebrities.
Well, in a way.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And he was the kind that would never talk about his wartime experiences. And he was, I don't know whether you remember this from history or not, but in January, 42, right after Pearl Harbor, before we had even stopped reeling from the shock and gotten started doing things, he was stationed at Floyd Bennett Field in New York, and I can't even think of the word, the stuff they see things in the sky on a screen was in its infancy.
The radar?
Radar was in its infancy.
Uh-huh.
And they saw a flight of German planes coming over the North Atlantic and passing Gander, Newfoundland, and the whole East Coast went on high readiness, guns and everything.
Yeah.
Well, my husband was stationed at this Naval Air Station. He was a sailor who never went to sea and an airman who never flew.
Okay.
He was in the Naval Air Force.
Yes.
And his job was working on PBYs, so he stood for 3 days up to his chest in that icy cold water in New York Harbor, keeping these PBYs ready for flight at any instant.
And PBY stands for?
PBY, I don't even know what it is, but it's
an
airplane with floats on it.
Uh-huh, uh-huh, okay.
And I don't think we even have any anymore. But
okay.
And so he came out of the water in 3 days with a cough and a fever, and that went into
pneumonia.
And when they photographed his chest, here he had white spots of tuberculosis all over. And that was what it was.
Yes.
And so he was discharged, and instead of sending him to a naval hospital, he was discharged to go home and said, they said, stay in bed 7 years and you might get well. They didn't have veteran services
that's,
in those
that
days.
That was the course of treatment. Yeah, mm-hmm. They didn't know what
So he went home and stayed in a private state tuberculosis sanitarium for 2 years.
And this is while you were married?
No, this is before,
before.
I even met him.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And he got so bored with it, he couldn't stand it. So he checked himself out and enrolled at the University of Georgia, the first person under the GI Bill. And that's where I met him. He lived at the war had taken all the lady girls' dormitories.
Uh-huh, yes.
And so I lived in the Chi Phi house
without
the man.
Well.
Which was next door to the YMCA, about as... Well, you could almost jump from roof to roof, but not quite. And he used to come over to the Chi Phi house and play bridge in the afternoons sometimes with the girls, and that's how we met. And the first words he ever spoke to me were, "You play the dumbest bridge of any person I've ever seen." And so we were married.
I was going to say, it sounds like true love to me. Well, now, tell me his name.
His name was Alvin Thomas Wallace, and he was named for Alvin York from World War I, because he was born in 1921.
Okay, okay. Now, when you met him, tell me, did he have residual health difficulties? Or?
They never could find another spot on his leg. He was x-rayed every 6 months the rest of his life by the Veterans Administration. Yeah. And that's what killed him, the exposure to radiation. So much he died of cancer from radiation poisoning.
Yeah.
When he died, he had 9 times the lethal level of radiation in his fatty tissues.
So many ironies.
Mm-hmm. He died at 49.
49?
Mm-hmm. So he just barely had time to implant the babies in me.
I suppose that's the way to look at it, yeah. Well, now tell me, how many babies are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about 3. The first one was Alvin T. Wallace, Jr., and he was run over by a car on University Avenue when he was coming out of nursery school at age 3.
Oh, what year was that?
1954.
Oh, no, Jack.
And I didn't think I was going to survive that.
I don't know.
I didn't think I could. And you know what? What was his name? Bill, somebody who was the head of the student union, belonged to our church, and he said, "I've got a job for you if you want it." I just leaped at it. He put me to the plug-ins, old-fashioned plug-in switchboard.
The switchboard.
Just so I wouldn't have to stay at home by myself.
Yes. Oh, yes.
So I did that till I took 2 years to get pregnant again.
Yes.
So I did that a few months, and then I got on the school list for substitutes, and I substituted for a couple of years.
Any particular grade or any school?
I taught at Gainesville High School, and I taught there for about 2 years before I got pregnant again.
Uh-huh.
I taught French, journalism, and senior English, and I had a blast.
Did you like it?
I just loved it. Just loved it. I had taught 4 years at North Carolina State. I was the only female on the faculty.
Oh, I'm sure.
In those days.
Yes.
Taught journalism and technical writing at North Carolina State.
Oh, yes.
That was very interesting because I had people as students who went on to be leaders in their profession.
In their field.
And I still have one that still calls me about once a year.
Well, you know, you forget what impact you have on people as they, you know, at a crucial period.
I appreciate it. I weighed 105 pounds, and I had long, blonde platinum page boy down my hair. I couldn't walk across the campus without getting whistled at.
Those were the days, huh?
Boy, yeah. But my husband, we graduated in 1950, and we had an offer to go to Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
As the head geneticist, his field was nuclear genetics. He was the first PhD in nuclear genetics ever anywhere.
Really?
And we had an offer from Dole Pineapple in Hawaii to go out and be head of that.
Yes?
Whole operation. And I said, "No, I don't want to have my children offshore. I want to have my children in America."
Uh-huh.
So we didn't go.
Uh-huh.
And then we got the offer down here. And he came down as an assistant professor, and in about 5 years he was chairman of the department.
Really?
And after that he was dean of the College of Agriculture.
Is that right?
Shortly thereafter.
Oh, how wonderful.
So he just went,
yes, yes.
And,
well, now,
it was very interesting.
Now you went into the service when?
Well, I was in the service, but this was in ROTC when I was in college.
Uh-huh.
And I was a first lieutenant in the cavalry. And
how did that come about?
Because I like to ride horses.
That counts.
And the university had a U.S. Cavalry contingent there.
Uh-huh.
And I wheedled and wheedled and wheedled until I got permission to ride with the boy, with the male cavalry.
And you were the only female.
I was the only female.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
And my horse, let me get you a picture of me on my horse.
All right, okay.
Thick with flying U, flying letter U, who served in World War I when he was 3 years old. So that was his second war. And when the war was over, they wouldn't just let him go to some nice horse farm and retire. They sent that whole cadre of horses that were the same age to an abattoir in Virginia, and they were slaughtered and canned for dog food. And I cried for 2 weeks.
Oh, I would still be crying, I think.
I still do. It was a lovely horse.
And that's the trophy you're holding that's in the picture?
Yeah, that's it. Needs a little polish. First place in the jumping competition.
Webb Crawford Cup. Isn't that something? Now, where was this picture taken?
It was Athens, Georgia, at the barn.
And now tell me what the process is. Now, you were in this ROTC,
mm-hmm.
and you were riding horses. You're assigned a horse,
assigned a horse for a certain length of time, and then you have to change to another horse so you don't just get used to one.
So yes.
And I trained with the men that were being trained.
Yes.
And... the next year.
Let me hand you the yours is a little stronger. She likes hers a lot more sugar.
Oh,
I don't know about you.
Thank you very much.
Just lemonade, but
yeah,
that's lemonade. Wonderful.
And what did I say last?
So you were trained just.
I trained exactly the way with the boys.
Yes.
With the men students.
Now you were a junior or
I started as a sophomore and sophomore, junior and senior years.
Okay. All right.
I graduated early so I didn't have a full senior year.
Uh-huh.
But and then in 1944 the horses were all decommissioned and the horse cavalry turned into the tank corps.
Yes.
And the horses were either done. All I kept was a few horses for demonstration and ceremonial purposes in Washington.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't big enough to drive a tank.
That seems like some kind of discrimination. I don't know where that fits.
Well,
but
I didn't even think about discrimination in those days.
Well, now, so you stayed in the service or
no,
not?
No, this was ROTC, so it didn't interfere with my college, and it was over when I graduated.
I see.
And I forgot I had ever been in it.
Yeah.
Until Phil started talking about it.
Yeah.
I was telling him about it. He said, my God, you're a veteran too.
Yes.
And we were.
Sure. Sure.
And I had a really hard-bitten old wonderful sergeant that ran our contingent, the one I rode with.
Uh-huh.
And he called me Dunstan. And one day we were doing a demonstration in a ring at the end of the year to show off.
Sure.
And my horse jogged just before we went over the jump. This was a 6-foot wood fence he had to jump over.
Uh-huh.
And he, instead of just going up, he went, and then up. Well, he went over, I flew off, he fell on me, and the fence fell on both of us. And you know what my sergeant said? Get up, Dunstan, and go around again. And I knew I felt kind of dizzy for 2 or 3 days. 30 years later, I fell in the yard over here, and I had to go over and get my head x-rayed. And they said, when did you get this concussion right up here? And I couldn't think of it. Finally, I thought, and they said, yes, this is an old, old injury.
Yes, but you definitely had one.
Yeah. And I got up and went around again, and that's when I got the first prize.
Oh, that's amazing. That's
well,
amazing.
It was amazing too.
Well, now, did you learn to ride when you were growing up in the country?
A little bit. We didn't have horses. That would have been the dream of my life. But
yeah.
one of our neighbors had horses for a riding academy. And they had a little girl who was my sister's age, and the three of us played together. So I learned to ride there.
Sure.
But that's civilian style.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Military riding is very, very different.
Well, tell me what they taught you. I mean, the purpose of that unit. I mean, they were training you as horses had been used in battle, yes?
Yes, they were. So we did long cross, like 30-mile treks.
I see. Yes.
And you had to take care of your own horse.
So all the care.
All the care. And we had this ceremonial stuff. We had to learn to do all the stuff that they learned in Fort Riley.
Yes.
To do ceremonially.
Sure.
We had to learn, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting, and I loved every minute of it.
Oh, I bet. I bet.
And including the concussion.
Well, now, did you have a rank?
What was your lieutenant.
First lieutenant. Uh-huh. Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, how were you treated by the other fellas? I mean,
sort of like their toy.
Yeah.
It was those days.
It was a little bit unique.
Yeah, it was unheard of.
Sure.
And so they were very solicitous some of the time, and then other times they maybe toe the line just like anybody else, and then they said,
"Yeah,
Dustin, get up and come on."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And one time we were galloping through a dense forest, and my horse got too close and scraped my arm, and I fell off.
Uh-huh.
And nobody stopped to help me get back on.
No.
I was on my own.
Sure. If you're going to play with the big boys.
Yeah, you got to do what the big boys do. So it was an education, particularly to a very Southern lady type person that I had been trained to be at home.
Yes, yes.
Out in public and at school and everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And in those days, the professors called you Miss Dunstan even if you were only 16 years old.
Yeah, yeah. It was the formality that we don't have today.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you finished school, why, you never saw any more service?
No.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you were growing up, was politics important in your family? Did you have any?
Yes, it was, because my mother was from a staunch Republican family.
Uh-huh.
And my father had been a Democrat since 1789.
So there were interesting conversations.
Well, there were. We learned what to avoid in conversation. My grandparents never called Roosevelt anything but that man. They would never say his name. And, of course, in the South, we thought he was wonderful.
Yeah.
Although I had Georgia in-laws who would call him Damn Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Goddamn Roosevelt.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he set up cotton quotas and things like that.
Yeah.
And they didn't believe it.
That affected them. It. Yeah. Sure. Sure. What about religion when you were growing up? Was that important?
My father taught at a Methodist owned and sponsored college, Greensboro College for Women, which had a reputation of having the highest rate of marriage among its graduates of any other Methodist college in the South.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
And we always had a house full of college girls. Some of them lived with us for periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
But my parents were very liberated and liberal, both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, but he was required by his contract to attend Methodist church every Sunday during the school year. The summer he got off.
Part of the contract.
So we saw that hypocrisy.
Absolutely.
From the very beginning.
Yes.
And even though I went to Sunday school.
Yes.
I knew how much of it was myth and how much of it was a way of controlling the masses and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I didn't really understand personally the value and the draw of religion until I came down here and we joined the church that Thaxton Springfield was the minister of. And my husband and Thaxton Springfield were very close friends. They had lunch together every Friday for years, and they died within 3 months of each other.
Is that right?
And Molly just died last year.
I remember. Well, now, we kind of left off. You had a second child.
Yeah, I had a second child. In
2 years after the first.
Yeah, 2 years after Skippy's death in 1954.
Yes.
And did I show you the picture of Skippy? Where did I put it down? Oh, here it is over here, I think. Yes, this is Skippy.
And he was born, tell me again, what year?
51.
He was born in 51.
And lived till 54.
Uh-huh.
And this is my daughter a couple of years ago. She's the CEO of the finance department for Disney. She has a mind like a steel trap.
Oh, my goodness.
Not any more like me than you can possibly
imagine. Oh, how wonderful.
And this is my oldest grandchild, who's now junior at UF.
And taking what? Studying what?
Finance.
Good.
And my son, well, I don't seem to have any pictures of him.
Okay. And he,
My son took over. When my parents moved down here, we got them found and they bought a farm out near Alachua. 90 acres of prime land on the top of the highest hill in Alachua County.
Oh.
And I designed and built their house for them before they ever saw it.
Now, you said you designed this house, too. Now, uh-huh.
And
where's
the beach house.
And where's all this background?
I just enjoyed it. I read architectural magazines
and
drew house plans when I was 12 years old.
Really?
Kind of thing. If I had been any good at math, I probably would have been an architect. But I couldn't add 6 and 7 and get 13.
That, well, so I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's
Go
okay.
back to your parents' house.
And my parents' house, we bought them 90 acres, found 90 acres, they bought 90 acres. they lived until, Daddy died in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother moved to California to live with my sister, whom she had supported all of her life, husband and 6 children and everything. And I was still working, so I couldn't have her live here with me without a full-time caregiver. And she didn't want to do that.
Yes.
So she lived out there until she died, 87 to 93.
Uh-huh.
She lived out there with them. And the house has stood empty except for visitors. My son graduated in biology at UF, and he took over the farm. And it has been for a long time a very successful operation called Chestnut Hill, because my father was the person who resurrected the extinct chestnut tree from, it was completely, there used to be 50 million acres of wild chestnut trees all up and down the Appalachian chain.
Mm-hmm.
And a blight brought in by a Chinese vessel in New York in 1903 wiped them out, totally, just totally. In about 1957, a botanical friend of my father's was walking in a virgin forest in Illinois, Ohio, and found one big old chestnut tree still alive. And he sent cuttings of that to my father. And from those cuttings, my father propagated the present day chestnut population, which is like 20 million.
Really?
And chestnut is very valuable wood because it makes gorgeous furniture.
Oh, yes.
It feeds livestock.
Ah.
It makes fence posts that will last 500 years.
I didn't know that.
And my father never made a nickel on it. He gave everything away. Just, one plant breeder to another.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, when he died, my son moved out to the farm, built his own house down at the bottom of the hill, and runs Chestnut Hill Tree Farm and Nursery, which is now a $20 million a year business.
How wonderful.
And how that's been a wonderful. Great blessing. You know, it was a gift.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, but just, what a valuable, you know, service and preservation.
And he loves it, and the children love it, and the children say they're going to stay there forever. They don't intend to leave. But, you know, they will.
Well, maybe, but maybe not all of them. Uh-huh. That's wonderful.
And my daughter-in-law is a musician, so the grandchildren are very musical as well as smart.
Wonderful. That's just wonderful. What's your son's name?
Robert Dunstan Wallace.
Robert, okay.
Named for my father, who was Robert Taylor Dunstan.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Well, it's nice to have him close by.
Yes, it is, and I don't see him very often.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're all busy in different ways.
That's right, that's right.
Day before yesterday was my husband's birthday, so Phil and I took flags and went out to the cemetery and put flags down on Skippy's grave, which is next to his, and my husband's grave. And I called up my son, and he had called me the day before and said, which day is it? I can't remember which day it was.
Yeah.
Is it 21st or 20th?
Yeah.
And he was really touched that Phil and I had gone together out there to do that. And, of course, the VFW post puts flags out on the graves on November the 10th.
Yes, yes.
But here's our flag that's big out there on the graves.
Oh, and that's wonderful.
I usually go out at least once a year. And when the children come at Christmas time, we go out together.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So he's not forgotten.
Oh, no. No, not at all.
I can hardly keep the tears from and he's been dead 37 years.
Well, but I think those things that are so near and dear, I don't think they get dull. I mean, they're just as real.
They don't get worn out.
No.
I just see it differently.
Sure, sure.
With the passage of time, and the children are very
well now
conscious.
after now your daughter is the youngest, is that correct?
Uh-huh. She's 2 years younger than Bob.
And so she was born what year?
1959. She's 2.5 years younger than Bob.
Okay, so in 59. And then, so when did your husband die?
In 1971.
Yeah.
They were 12 and 14, is absolutely the worst possible time for a boy to lose his father.
That's right. That's right. And I'm sure that was really, really hard on them.
Oh, it was terrible. Just terrible.
Which compounded it for you.
Mm-hmm. And yet they were both able to heal in their own ways and go on with their lives.
Yeah.
And Bob said to me several months ago, said, you know, Mom, I was thinking about it. If Daddy had lived, we wouldn't have accomplished nearly as much as we have. We wouldn't have been nearly as strong as we are because he would have spoiled us to death. And that's true.
Well, yes, but you sure don't think of those things at the time.
No.
You know, you... You don't.
But I thought it was interesting that Bob, at age 50, would
see that in retrospect. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, that's pretty insightful. And when you look back on the struggles over your life, you say, you know, it did make me stronger. But
mm-hmm. Kay has said that independently too.
Sure.
And of course, it made me a lot stronger than I ever would have dreamed of being.
Yeah.
I had 32 years by myself, which I developed a full-blown career and got minorly famous. And
well, I was going to say, tell me about that. I mean, you know, you said it took you a while, you know, just to kind of get your sea legs again.
Oh, it did. And the first book I wrote, I don't think I brought it out here. Maybe I did. No, I guess I didn't. It was called Widow's Weeds and How They Grew. And Morris Storter published that for me.
Really?
To get me started. Mm-hmm. And it was reviewed all over the country, and it sold out twice.
Well, how exciting. And was that your very first publication?
My first book publication. I'd been writing articles.
Articles,
for years,
yeah.
So I got a lot of mileage out of that. I got invited to all kinds of places and churches and schools and universities and
how wonderful.
All over the U.S. I've spoken in almost every state.
Isn't that thrilling? And that would never have happened.
It never would have happened.
out of regular circumstances.
Right. So it took that kind of breaking up inside to release a lot of me. When I was married, I didn't feel as though I had the right to compete. Not with my husband, but for me to compete with myself for attention to the writing and attention to the family. Because I knew if I ever got deep enough into the writing, I'd forget all about the family.
Well, and we were from a generation that
you couldn't do that. So it has all worked out according to random chance and whatever.
And whatever the stars have planned for us.
Whatever the stars have planned or fate or whatever you believe in.
All of that. Yeah. And so when did your current love come through the door?
Well.
Or return?
Very recently, yeah. as I said, we went all the way through high school together. We had one date, but we played together. We were just good friends. And I didn't hear from him or even think about him till we had our 50th class reunion. And he wasn't living in the same place, but he came and I saw him there, and we sat by each other at the banquet, and I thought, gee, I'd like to invite him up to my hotel room.
But did you?
I didn't, because he was still married and I knew that.
Yes.
And his wife was an invalid.
Yes.
So he was having a very rare night out himself.
Sure.
And then some years after that, I started writing the history of, at the request of the Historical Association in Greensboro, to write about this community we lived in called Pinecroft, which was originally hoped to be a weekend retreat around several lakes with log cabins and that sort of thing. And then the Depression came, and that all, so people just moved out there. So we lived in the country, and Phil's grandmother lived across the street from me.
Yes.
And he stayed with her in the summertime, so we played together.
Sure.
And where was I? Okay. 50th anniversary, we saw each other, and that was it. Some months later, I was writing this history of Pinecroft, which was an unusual settlement. And there were things, dates and names I had totally forgotten, and I called the one person that still lived in our hometown that I knew, Eleanor Taylor. We'd been close friends in high school. She was the high school newspaper editor, and I was the feature writer.
Oh.
And that's how I won my scholarship, with a feature I wrote for that newspaper, high school newspaper, on teenage fashion, and it was called "Oh Me, Oh My, I Bought My Britches When the Water Was High."
I love it.
So that changed my whole life forever. Anyway, I keep going off.
My friend calls these rabbit trails.
Okay,
you know, you get off on a sidetrack, and you think, now where was I going with this?
Yeah. Anyway.
So you were writing this history, and you called her to...
And I called her to ask some dates and names and street numbers and that sort of thing. She said, I can't remember, but I'll put you in touch with somebody who can. She gave me his phone number.
I'll be darned.
And I called him up, and he almost dropped dead.
I bet. Who is this, really?
So I had a number of questions, and I sent him the list of questions, and he wrote them all back, and we had occasion to talk two or three times after that. And his wife was very seriously ill. She had been an invalid for years and an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me about how bad off she was. Her heart was beginning to give out, and he was just, dancing attendance every minute.
Yeah, difficult.
Well, I knew how that was to be with a spouse who was dying.
Yes.
For months and months on end.
Yes.
And we talked several times, I don't know how many times, as she got closer and closer to death. he called me more and more often.
Well, you know, that kind of support.
Who was it who he talked to?
I was going to say, and someone who already understands.
Yeah. And his oldest son had MS, so this was the other thing.
Oh,
and
my word.
His son just died this last March.
Oh, my word.
At 60. And he has another child, a daughter, who's 2 years older. And we were just with her a couple of weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
So there was a connection that had, you know, even though it had been lost, it was reestablished.
And I bet you with knowing him the way you did as children, you know, they say
we had so many common memories.
Basically, you don't change all that much, that you are the same person you were.
And in addition, he lived right there across the street from my parents all those years. So he always knew where I was, but I didn't know anything about
him. Yeah, yeah.
And so the day she died, he called me before he called the funeral home to come and get her. And one thing led to another. We talked sometimes 2 and 3 and 4 times a day.
Yeah.
And it did seem to help him because I knew what he was going through.
Sure you did.
He knew I knew.
Yes, yes.
And so that was in November the 19th. And February the 13th, he came down for a 2-week visit. And he never left. He went home to get his things, and that's all.
And this was what year?
04.
So not long.
Not long. And he's made the most remarkable adjustment to just pick up and leave where he had been forever and come down to a new place. Well, I wrote and told all kinds of groups about him, so he had some connections ready-made for him when he got here.
Yeah,
and he has just taken root in the most amazing way.
How wonderful.
He's sort of the grandfather of all the veterans organizations in Alachua County, and there are only 22 of them.
Well, I already know that. Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, if you want to know something, you know, here's his card. And and I had asked Roberta at our office, I said, I need Mrs. Wallace's number, and she says, oh, there's 2 cards on my desk. And they were kind of on top of this stack of papers, and I thought, well, it's obviously the go-to number. No question about this.
So he's made himself really needed and most serviceable.
Oh, and it is so important to be getting these stories. Mm-hmm. You know, every time I started out summarizing some of them for the internet, then I was transcribing one that they wanted in a hurry. And, you know, I told you I'm learning my history at this late date. But,
well, I have learned a great deal about World War II.
Oh, yes.
Heard about before.
Yeah. It's
or
just,
would have thought to explore.
There's something about the oral history, the reading the dates and names of famous leaders in a book is not the same as
hearing about it from
the person in the trenches who had this personal experience mm-hmm. and tells about it. I can relate to that. I don't know why that means more to me, but
well, it makes it more accessible on a personal
It does. I'm
basis.
Just hooked in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, we have a friend who was at Pearl Harbor. We met here. And we go to veterans things, different ones, probably 2 or 3 days a week, 2 or 3 nights a week.
I bet.
And he's on the telephone all the time. It's just made a tremendous, you know, he feels really needed.
Such a service, you know, and not everyone has either the emotional wherewithal or the personality to be the organizer,
and he is.
I wanted to ask you mm-hmm. about the poppies.
Okay.
Now we have this wonderful picture, and I'll give you a copy of both of these pictures, but it'll go in the file.
Okay.
And
well, she was my English teacher in 1943, 44, and 45. 43, and then I knew her as a person after that.
She was talking about, how do you say her name?
Moena.
Moena.
Moena is a variation of the French word moine, little sparrow.
Little sparrow, okay. Mm-hmm. M-O-I-N-A, okay.
In 1918, 4 hours before the armistice, the man she was engaged to be married, was shot simultaneously with the German that he killed down the trenches.
Across the trenches.
Mm-hmm. And the next year, she cut up the first anniversary of the armistice. She cut up the red dress she'd been saving to wear for him for her their engagement party or something. She was already engaged to him. She cut up and made silk poppies, and I walked the, no, that was later, and distributed the poppies on the streets of Athens, Georgia, which is the first time anybody had ever thought of that.
Yes.
And now 49 countries do this.
Yes. They're everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere.
And so when I was in Athens, as I said, she was my English teacher, and she chose me out of all the other 3,000 co-eds there to walk with her and distribute the poppies.
Oh, really?
And we were written up in the Atlanta Journal and the Constitution, which were separate then. And the Athens, Georgia Banner Herald, and I sent copies home to my hometown newspaper. And that was a great honor. As we said, we couldn't find a picture of Moena, Miss Moena, that would take on that, so we substituted a mother with the same hairdo.
But I think you're right. You know, that it's the same era.
Same era.
She resembles her, and same hairdo. Mm-hmm. I think that was brilliant.
That was my mother's engagement picture, and it sat on my father's dresser out at the farm all his life.
Oh, that's even more special, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now what is your part now? Do you take over that responsibility?
Well, I gave the farm to my son.
Oh, I was thinking of the poppies. Excuse me.
Oh, the poppies. Yeah. Oh, yes. Last several years, I've stood out in front of Walmart on Poppy Day and passed out poppies. And 90% of the people who took them, and sometimes they wanted to pay me for them, and I said, no, they're free. They had no idea what the significance was.
That's
so
what I was going to ask you.
Phil and I are trying to bring this back.
Yes.
And
we need somebody to write a nice article for the Gainesville Sun.
Mm-hmm. Well, there have been several in there, and it's time for somebody to do it again. I need to call.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jacqueline.
Well, now, if you look back over your life, what are some of your proudest moments? Do you have a special thing that...
Well, Phil and I just got legally married on September the 18th.
So that's
that's the most recent one.
That's the most recent one. But you've got several landmarks throughout your...
Well, when my father was on his deathbed, he hadn't spoken for about a week. And he died. We took care of him out at the farm. We had 5 nurses.
Yes, rotating.
Rotating. And I was still working, so I went out before. I went to work in the morning, came back at my lunch hour, came back when I got out of school.
Oh, my goodness.
Stayed there till they got asleep, and then came back here. And my father was within, I guess, 2 or 3 days of dying, and the medicine we were giving him had stained, his beard grew because we couldn't shave him.
Sure.
And he'd had a red beard when I was a child, and here was this red beard back again, and with his approach to dying, every wrinkle in his face smoothed out, and he was this, looked as young as a 20-year-old.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. And I was getting ready to give him his medicine, and he opened his eyes and he said, "You've always been my good little girl." So I went to the bathroom and cried and cried and cried.
That just never...
My mother, by that time, was so far into Alzheimer's that she didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And it protected her.
Yes.
And she would look at me at that same time and say, "Do I know you, little girl? You seem like such a nice little girl." I'd go in the bathroom and cry.
Cry, oh, yeah. That's such a sadness.
They were wonderful parents. My mother would always say, "You have to decide this for yourself, darling." And looking back, I wasn't that smart with my kids all the time.
but that was such a good lesson to be independent.
And I did say that to them many times. You have to decide this for yourself.
Yes, yes.
And so they got used to making decisions.
It's important. Mm-hmm. It's important. Yeah. Okay. Then when you look back, are there challenges, maybe we've already talked about it, we talked about pushes you to new growth or things that you overcame?
Becoming a widow and a dependent wife was probably the biggest thing.
Yes.
Because I had to start from square one. I had been spoiled to death. My parents let me make decisions for myself, but my husband was an autocrat of the old-fashioned school. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And everything had to go through him. And that was fine. I thrived on it, too.
Sure, sure.
But I have learned how to be strong and self-reliant.
Yes, yes.
And that's a big, big thing.
And a lot of people don't ever have that opportunity.
Yeah. And I would say I used to be afraid of a lot of things, and I can't think of anything that makes me fearful anymore.
Is that an A+? That's just...
Well, I'd have to say worrying about my grandchildren in their fast cars. The big things that you worry about.
Yeah.
At least until the last week, I was financially secure.
Oh.
Who knows what it is now?
I'm doing a great case of denial. Don't even want to look every time the television says it's down further.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be okay, because unless the state of Florida goes defunct, I get two retirement checks from the state of Florida.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something to really rely on. Yeah. Are there other things that you'd like to include, or other things that I haven't asked you that you would like
to? I think I've learned how to love differently, to love less selfishly.
Excellent, excellent.
To allow other people to be themselves rather than just, you know, when your kids are little, they're just an extension of you.
Yes.
And it took me a long time. I let them go ahead and do it, but it took me a long time to let go in here.
Of course, of course.
And I'm 83. And I'd say I've had, in spite of everything, in spite of all the downtime, I've had a wonderful life, and I'd live it over again in a twinkle if you'd give me a chance.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing to be able to say, isn't it?
Well, it makes me feel good in here.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, yes.
I don't feel... I could have done a lot more as a writer, but only at the expense of people.
Something else. Yes, that's right. So the choices that you've made...
Mm-hmm. have been... I agree with them.
Yes, yes, that you would make them again.
Yeah, I'd make them
good,
again.
Bad, or indifferent. Yes, because...
And I haven't made many mistakes. I made hardly any.
Well, and the decisions that you've made have made you the person that you are today. And to be comfortable with that, mm-hmm. is a very positive thing.
When I was much, much younger, growing up and a teenager, I didn't think I was as physically attractive, that it was possible to be as physically attractive as I would have liked to be.
Yes, yes.
And I'm perfectly comfortable being 40 pounds overweight.
This is who we are?
Yeah.
Like it or not. Mm-hmm. Well, I just officially on the tape want to just thank you so much for your time
and
your
you
wonderful stories.
Your ear off, I know.